They took the camera to the airport to cover Jeff's return, knowing that they had just told a grief-stricken father about his son being raped. And my dad, with this knowledge, went to the Baton Rouge airport with a .38 snub-nosed revolver in his boot. And when the police brought Jeff by, he turned around, shot him one time right in front of the television camera. So the news that night was Daddy shooting Jeff.
Every raindrop reflecting on the water as the sun shuts her eyes. Don't know why you'll uncover. Watch the tide rolling with the moonlight. Everything is silent on this Louisiana night.
We are Missing Magnolias, and we are talking to a very special guest, Mr. Jody Cloche. Jody, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you, and I don't want to say too much about your story or what you do. I would rather you do that.
So when I was in fifth grade, my mother enrolled me, my older brother, and my little brother into a karate class, which ultimately led to us taking karate from a man named Jeff Doucette. Unbeknownst to my parents, Jeff Doucette was a pedophile. He was kind of like a classic stereotype pedophile. So we started taking karate. Eventually, Jeff used that and gained the trust of the parents. And my mother had a background check ran on him by my uncle who worked for the sheriff's department. Everything supposedly came back fine. So eventually, he started spending more time with the family. He groomed the family, gained their trust. And after knowing him for maybe 3 or 4 months, maybe 5 months, he started testing my boundaries by doing kind of a little inconspicuous touching to where if I would have said, hey, what are you doing? He could have brushed it off as an accident. And then he went on to almost have a full-time sexual relationship with me for almost a year. He would perform oral sex on me, and then he would have sex with me. And that went on until February of 1984. It started in 1983 and went to February 1984. And in February of 1984, Jeff had written some bad checks. He'd scammed some people out of some money. And he had a court date where he had to either come up with the money or face the consequences. And instead of facing the consequences because he couldn't come up with the money, he decided to leave town. And when he left town, since I was his love interest for the past year, he decided to take me with him. And he took me from my house. He went to his mother's house in Fort Arthur, Texas. We took my mother's car. That was on a Sunday. His mother called my mother and said that Jody's here with Jeff and Jeff's going to be bringing him back in the morning. His mother, he needed to get to New York City. So he got money for a bus ticket to quote unquote New York, but really it was LA. And we never passed through Baton Rouge. He never dropped me off. Me and him took the bus to California. My mother and the sheriff's deputies, they arrived in Port Arthur literally the same time our bus was leaving it from Orange, Texas. So they just missed us. And we took a 2-day bus trip out to LA, took a bus to Anaheim. The next night I went to Disneyland and we were at the Samoa Motel in Anaheim, California, 425 West Catella, literally around the block from Disneyland. And he let me call my mother and let her know I was okay. And I made a collect phone call. They traced the call back to the hotel and they arrested him and they took me into custody. They took me to the police station, questioned me. They took me to the hospital and they did a rape kit. And then eventually they took me to this child's home for neglected kids where I spent the day. And then I ended up catching a flight at 1:10 a.m. out of Los Angeles heading to New Orleans on March 1st, 1984. I was returned home March 1st, 1984. A week later, the hospital report came back because I had been lying. I'd been saying that Jeff had never touched me. And so the hospital report came back positive for spermatozoa on the rectal slide, which means, you know, obviously Jeff had been full of me. And I came clean. When my mother, you know, confronted me with the information, I told the truth. And a week later, Mike Burnett with the Baton Rouge Sheriff's Department, Bud Connor, they flew out to LA to extradite Jeff back from California to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Well, my dad was, you know, having lunch at the Cotton Club. It was a local restaurant, and he would sit at the bar area, and he was eating gumbo because it's in his deposition. Fridays, they serve gumbo at the Cotton Club, so he was eating his gumbo. And a program director from Channel 2, a news station that my father used to work for, he was on the bowling team. He knew everybody. He was friends with everybody. Bob Shadell looked at my dad, and he said, "Have they? You know, when are they bringing your boy back, talking about Jeff?" And my dad said, "I think he's back already," and they wouldn't tell me, you know, if he was. And Bob said, "Well, I'll go find out for you." So he went and he called the news station, said, "What time is Doucette getting in?" And they said, oh, he'll be in at 9:08 tonight. So he went back and told my dad, oh, no, he'll be in at 9:08 tonight. So in a way, my dad was kind of set up. I don't think they thought daddy was going to do what he did. But they took the camera to the airport to cover Jeff's return, knowing that they had just told a grief-stricken father about his son being raped. So they figured some type of conflict going to happen. Now, this has never been confirmed. This is just me speculating. But, I mean, it makes sense. And my dad, with this knowledge, went to the Baton Rouge Airport with a .38 snub-nosed revolver in his boots, got on the phone talking to his best friend, and when the police brought Jeff by, he turned around, shot him one time right in front of the television camera. So the news that night was daddy shooting Jeff, and he was arrested for attempted second-degree murder because Jeff wasn't officially dead. He didn't officially die till the next day. They kept him on life support to harvest his organs, and then he was booked with second-degree murder, and eventually, when all things played out, after he had to fire his first lawyer, get a new lawyer, he was offered a deal. He put no contest to manslaughter, and he was given 7 years hard time, but the judge suspended the sentence to 5 years probation and 300 hours community service. So my father shot the guy who kidnapped and sexually molested me in front of a television camera, and all he got was probation.
Wow, it's a lot to unpack. Did you know from the get-go, like, oh gosh, this is bad, I'm being taken?
He had told me, he didn't tell me when, but he told me, he said, look, I got this court date coming up, and if I can't get the money, he was going to ask some people if he could borrow the money. He said, if I can't get the money, he was, I'm leaving, I'm going to California, I'm taking you with me. At that point, I was so much under his control that I just kept my mouth shut and went.
Can we go back a little bit? I know that we haven't mentioned your 2019 book yet, Why, Gary, Why, the Jody Plushay Story. And a lot of the book is really like almost a how-to for parents and how to spot this predatory behavior in the grooming process. What were the early kind of indoctrination habits and techniques? And did you have an interest in karate? Like, how did you fall into that? Was that something your parents forced on you?
I didn't have no interest whatsoever in karate. As a matter of fact, the flyer that they gave me in fifth grade never made it out the room. I threw it in a garbage can as I walked out the door that day. My little brother went to another school in the same school district because he was younger. I was in fifth grade. He was in, I think, second or third grade. And I was involved in football, basketball, baseball, soccer. So I really didn't feel like I had time for karate. But my little brother, he wasn't involved in anything. So my mother felt like maybe this would be something to get him involved in something he might enjoy. So they actually put me in karate just kind of because they were putting my brother in karate. So I had no interest. The earliest onset for me, consciously as a 10-year-old, was Jeff said, who wants to drive the car? And he put us in our lap, and I was driving the car. He was doing the stick shift, and he put his hands in my lap and kind of moved his hands a little bit, touching me. But it seemed like it was an accident. That was that inconspicuous touch where if I would have said, Jeff, your hands are in my lap. You need to move them. Then he'd be like, I'm sorry. And then he would have never tried anything else on me. Okay. And so that's the first time in my consciousness. Looking back, it started earlier than that. I would say when we were at karate, school, we would be stretching, and he would like, you got to feel the burn right here between your thighs, and he'd reach in between and feel us for our, you're tight right here. You know? And I think that was kind of his introduction to really not doing anything sexual, but getting me acclimated to him touching around my private areas. So that would be my, as an adult looking back, that would be to me the initial testing of the boundaries.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense in what we understand about the literature generally. You know, I've had somebody ask, like, well, why don't people catch them when they're grooming people? And I'm like, no, the grooming is, a lot of it's normal ways to make friends. It's like being nice. And also this secret pushing boundary stuff that, just like you said, they create contexts that are easy to justify it, to get you to doubt yourself. And when everything else is so good, why would you think that was this ill intention when there was no other evidence?
Right. There was a situation in the summer of 83. We had fought a karate tournament in Fort Worth, Texas. And my Uncle Jeff, my dad's brother, lived in Dallas. So we were going to stay a couple of days and spend time with them. Well, Jeff didn't want me to stay with them. I was going to be gone for a week from him. He didn't want that. And as we got out of the car, he kissed me on the mouth. And my uncle, who didn't know Jeff from anybody, was like, that ain't right. He shouldn't be kissing kids on the mouth. And my dad defended Jeff. My dad was like, no, that's just Jeff's affection. He's good with kids. That's just how he is. And the whole family was blinded by this. And so my uncle, who didn't know Jeff at all, was like, nah, this ain't right. And by that time, my parents were so, I don't want to say under Jeff's spell, but they were so groomed and trusting that they couldn't see it.
Wow. Did you get the sense that there were other kids?
I didn't get the sense. I know there was other kids. I mean, for example, one night we were in bed and he wanted me to perform oral sex on him, and I told him I wasn't. And he said, well, if you don't do it, I'll wake so-and-so up and I'll get him to do it. I said, well, wake him up. And he did. And that was the kid who was older than me. Like, Jeff traded him in for me. And so that kid, when Jeff was like, will you, perform oral sex on me? That kid was, it's sad, but the kid was missing Jeff's attention. So he was happy to be back in Jeff's good side. So, I mean, I saw that with my own eyes. So I don't even have to speculate. And he confessed to me and two other boys, even though I suspect there were more than that.
That's another thing. The vast array of sex offenders have all kind of different risk factors, but true pedophiles are those offenders whose intention is to form that form of a sexual relationship with children. In other ways, they look like rule followers, right? Like they try really hard not to get in trouble with the law because what matters to them most is this relationship they're going to have with their child and ways that they can foster it. And there's a whole lot of planning that goes into that, despite what that offender might say at first, pre-treatment at least. At least that's what I understand about the literature. But I know that since you've grown up into an adult, you've done some really awesome stuff with advocacy, in addition to your book, with talking to families and children about things to look out for. Would you tell us a little bit about that? Like, is there something that you think made your family vulnerable?
I mean, my parents eventually did separate. And I mean, that's one of the things that child molesters look for. One less adult around, one less pair of eyes to pick up on some of the signs that you might be molesting their child. Also, it creates that dependency on the single mom. So Jeff would say, hey, I'll come pick the kids up and bring them to Variety. And she's like, oh, can you please? Thank you. So you have that dynamic as well. But with the work that I've done in 1991, I was just about 19 years old. Me and my dad went to New York City to film the Geraldo Rivera talk show. I just wanted a free trip to New York. I'd never been. And I thought it would be cool. We went to a Yankees game. So we went on the show, didn't think nothing of it. Came home. It aired June 4th, 1981. A couple days after it airs, I get a call from Mike Burnett with the local sheriff's department who led the investigation to rescue me. And he called me up and he said, I want you to hear this from me first. He said, this is going to be on the news tomorrow. He said, today we went and arrested this pastor who had been sexually abusing these two boys. And one of the boys came forward and said, he saw you on the Geraldo Rivera show. And that's what made him come forward. So that's when I knew I could take this terrible story and turn it into something good. So from that moment, I kind of knew what I wanted to do. So I made sure I graduated from LSU while I was there. I got three minors, which is actually a general studies degree. It's three minors. I got a minor in speech communication, a minor in psychology, and a minor in philosophy. And that way I could have a broader education. So I knew I wanted to do public speaking. That's why I took the speech courses. I knew I wanted to learn about the psychology of offenders and victims. So that's why I took psychology. The last two of my 7 years I was in college, I was in an organization called Men Against Violence. And I was able to travel to Orlando and present at the American College Health Association Conference and represent LSU. That next year, a couple groups from Men Against Violence, American College Health Association Conference was in New Orleans. And so we did a presentation there. So I knew that that's kind of what I wanted to do. So upon graduation, I moved to Irving, Texas, where I had gone to Northlake Junior College for 2 years. And so I wanted to move back to Irving. So I did that. And then I got a job as a karaoke host and a DJ, kind of looking for the ideal job. And finally, after not finding it for almost a year, I decided I would do a computer search. And I mean, it was old dial-up internet. And I went to, it was called careerpath.com. It's now careerbuilder.com. And I, at the time, you could only search like 10 cities. So I clicked 10 major cities, one of them being Philadelphia. I know I clicked San Diego because that's to this day where I still would want to live if all things were perfect. And so I clicked those cities. I typed in sexual abuse prevention and one job came up and it was in Norristown, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. And I eventually got that job, moved to Pennsylvania, worked as an education specialist for 2 years, going out in community doing safety education programs, mainly around sexual assault and sexual abuse. And then after 2 years, I became the supervisor of community education. So I was in charge and I did that for 5 years. So I had my 7 years experience. In April of 05, my dad had a stroke. And so that's when I decided, you know what, I need to move back home and I need to pursue my dream of public speaking and raising awareness. So I moved back home in July of 2005, 2 months before Katrina. And I had a couple speaking engagements over the last 15 years around the country. But I mean, I want to do, you know, 100, 150. I want to do colleges. You know, I'm speaking in New Orleans in February for like, you know, Department of Justice, did probation and parole a couple years ago. So, I mean, I love it. I did two presentations at a conference in New Orleans 2 weeks ago. I can't describe the feeling like, but I'm done with the presentation and I know that I've just done something good. It's a really great feeling. So that's kind of what I wanted to do. In 93, when I was at Northlake, I decided to start writing a book. So I wrote like 27,000 words and I put the project on the shelf. So 2016, I revisited. I hired a book writing company and we're turning it into an audiobook. I've got a friend of mine who has a studio in his house and he completed it. Having listened to it, going back through, reading it as I'm listening to it, I can say this with confidence. It is an excellent book. It has excellent information for parents, for people who deal with children, for victims, for survivors, for people who have no understanding of how this subject could even come about. It will give them a general understanding on how perpetrators act. So I think it should be the kind of go-to book for parents and victims of sexual assault. Even though Crystal didn't like it, if you go to Amazon and look at I got a brand new review and it was excellent. It was from a 15-year-old girl who says she was a victim. Y'all can go read it. But Crystal didn't like my book at all. And I screenshotted it and I posted it on Facebook. She said, oh, all he did was brag. And I put on Facebook, I said, look what Crystal had to say. And you know what? You're damn right I'm bragging. Okay. I was sexually abused for a year. I was kidnapped. My father shot the guy on TV. And I still managed to graduate from college. I was a four-sport letterman my senior year in high school. I went to Victim Services Center. I've actually done accompaniments to the hospital, to police station with rape victims. I've done trainings for police officers and lawyers. So, I guess in a way I am bragging and I'm proud of it.
Can I just say, I've listened to other interviews that you've done and I just admire so much your humor and your spirit. How do you tell other people that have experienced sexual assault? How do you tell them and convince them that there's hope on the other end of it? How do you pass on that ability to turn pain into laughter?
All right. In 92, when I first went to Northlake, I took a class, one like history, one like philosophy. It was just kind of like an elective. And one of the things that he pointed out is how you think is how you feel. And I guess that how you think is how you feel. So if you think that sexual abuse is the worst thing that can happen to you, I'll tell you right now, it's absolutely the worst thing that can happen to you. But if you think it's something that with the proper support, whether it's counseling, whether it's from a clergy member, whether it's from a good friend, I would advise to seek professional help because, I mean, don't do that to your friends. No, I'm kidding. But whoever you get your support from, mine was my mother. So whoever you get your support from, use that person and know that you can. It's like the grieving process. You can work through it and you can be okay.
I love that you're talking about this. I know that gender matters and men are less likely to talk about their sexual assault experiences. They're less likely to be believed by police and are treated positively in the media. So I'm sure that it's really important for people out there who may fear that stigma that you're somebody that is a very clear example that you can function very well without that.
Well, one of the things I did when I felt I was done with the book is in 2011, when the whole Penn State scandal went, you know, Jerry Sandusky, you know, I mean, I lived in Pennsylvania 7 years. I used to go to Penn State once a month. I love Penn State. It's a beautiful campus. And it made me sad seeing what was going on. Well, about a year after the whole thing went down, the Paterno family hired a former FBI profiler, Jim Clementi, who was a writer on the TV show Criminal Minds. And I read the Clementi report, and it literally changed my whole perspective on how I felt about Joe Paterno and the whole Penn State situation. And I thought I was the expert. So to have someone better than me, you know, an FBI profiler, and that was kind of like reassuring. It made me feel better that, like, there was more I had to learn. I wasn't as smart as I thought I was. And so I read that, and then someone from Investigation Discovery contacted me to do a TV show, and I recommended Jim. I was like, look, if you get a professional to come talk about this, I highly recommend Jim Clementi. This is who I want. And they actually got him on the show. So I reached out to Jim, and I sent him my book. I said, look, I'm sending this to you so you can read it. Let me know what you think. If you don't want to read it, don't read it. Well, he read it and he actually edited it. He went through and made changes. He gave me good notes on statistics. He put a paragraph in there about how Criminal Minds had featured one of their characters who had been sexually abused, who wanted to go work for the behavioral analysis unit, BAU. And so he was able to help me a lot. And one of the things that he told me is that he believes that males underreporting sexual abuse is probably higher than we suspect because of that factor, because they don't want people to know that they have been abused, because normally it's by another man. Typically when it's a woman, the kid won't shut up and they get the person in trouble. But and Jim was like, I suspect that it's like, and another thing he pointed out to me is parents are more likely, if Jeff's like, hey Jody, come ride with me, we're gonna go to the store, letting me go ride with him, than if they said, hey Sissy, come ride with me. They're not gonna let their, you know, 8-year-old girl go with a 25-year-old man to the store, where they're more likely to let their 10-year-old boy. With his help, I was able to get a really good, comprehensive, you know, knowledgeable book about the topic. And I did try to insert humor. I don't think it's so bad. I mean, you might have to put, like, you can read it in something, if you're a victim and it's something triggers you, you might put it down, but you'll be able to come back to it later. I made it that way on purpose. I specifically didn't go into any of the gory details because I didn't want to trigger a potential victim. So I kind of left it kind of generic and sprinkled a little humor in.
There's so many different kind of little stories along the way. Just to take us kind of back and fill in some of the pieces. You were 11 years old. You went to Disney during the kidnapping. I'm correct. You went to Disneyland. And then to go back, you rode a plane for the first time, you know, from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And then it was your first time on a plane. Such big moments during this period.
Oh, it was such a letdown. See, I was so excited. I got a window seat. And then when I fly now, to this day, I don't anymore because I got a phone. But I used to bring a robot with me so I could look out the window to follow where we are. I mean, I've, I was going to Green Bay to do a presentation in 2006, and we were flying over St. Louis, and they just so happened to have a day baseball game. And I can look out, I'm looking out the porch, and I'm looking at the Busch Stadium. The lights are on, and I told the flight attendant, I was like, hey, look, we're over St. Louis. And so she went over and she said, yeah, ladies and gentlemen, if you look out the right side of the plane, you'll see the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. And I think it's cool. And so I was all excited.
And then when you got off the plane, you had this big press event. Your mom was there to greet
you? My mom, my dad, my brother, and my uncle were there. And so were WBRZ Channel 2, John Pastrick, and the cameraman. Now, I'm waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm getting off the plane. My hair's been dyed black. They literally was an Asian family, a big Asian family in front of me. So when I walked off the plane, I was walking with them. I got 10 feet from my mother, and she didn't recognize me. I just kind of pointed to my hair, and she was like, ah. Well, I look up, and I see this camera. And she comes over and she gives me a hug. Oh, baby. And I'm like, what are they doing here? And she's, you know, hugging me. And she's like, oh, look at your hair. And I'm like, I'm not real happy. And she goes, smile, act like you're happy. And so you can see me go, you can literally see her lean over and you can see her hugging me, but she's whispering, smile, act like you're happy to be here. And you see me go, I crack this fake smile. And then John Pastrick walks up to me. He's like, you know, what do you think about all this? I'm like, nowadays they would never, ever, ever send a camera to a kidnapped victim coming home off the plane. They would never do that.
Yeah, I was watching that as somebody in 20, I guess, at the time. And I'm somebody who's just like somebody who's critical of the media generally, because we know it's biased in all kinds of ways. But also like just shocked that we were in a place where we treated victims and their families like that. Oh, gosh, it seems like a terrible idea, because that's such a critically emotional moment, and to have that camera and the world shoved in your face seems like a lot.
Have you ever seen, I think it's Netflix or Amazon Prime, it's called Trial by Media. It's like a 10-part. Okay, so I watched the one about, I think it was the Massachusetts sexual assault rape. It was the one that the movie The Accused was based off of. Okay, and I didn't know this. And it was funny because I'm sitting there like, I don't remember this. How come? I know I probably would have watched this. I was like, why don't I remember this trial? They had a rape trial literally aired on CNN. And when I watched it and they found out the dates, it was during the time I was kidnapped. So that's why I wasn't watching CNN. I wasn't reading the newspaper. So that's why I don't remember it. But I was sitting there going, holy Jesus, who thought this would be a good idea?
Exactly. Jeez Louise. I am assuming that the media then, just since that moment, has had its sort of spotlight on you.
Like I said, my dad used to work at Channel 2. He was friends with everybody at Channel 2. Channel 2 has always been good to me. It's not their fault, because my dad called him and said, hey, look, my son's coming back. He was trying to get them a news story, because he's thinking like someone who worked at the news station. So I don't blame my dad for doing it. I don't blame the news, but I just think about how it is now. They would never do that. But if daddy don't make that call for them to come film me coming back March 1st in New Orleans, they don't do the follow-up story on March 16th showing Jeff coming back. Because it was just a follow-up story on a story they had done 2 weeks ago. And they had put together a little package, because after we won the national championship in Fort Worth, daddy had got us on, you know, hey, this local karate team went to the nationals and they brought back all these trophies. So they did like a little feel good story on us. So they had that footage as well. So it's not that far fetched that they would do it. But if daddy doesn't make that call, they don't get the footage that they got. And for those who are unfamiliar with it, if you go to YouTube and type in WBRZ airport shooting, you can literally watch the news from the night it happened.
And what was that like for you watching that video for the first time, and where were you?
All right, so I actually went to bed that Friday night. I went to bed early without watching the news, but I usually used to watch the news. But I was just tired for some reason that day. I don't know, maybe because I've kidnapped, been going to the police stations, dyeing my hair black to blonde, all that going on. But I went to bed that night. Well, the next morning we woke up and we were out at False River, which is about 45 minutes from my house, our camp was. And our grandparents were like, get back in the car, going back to Baton Rouge. And we didn't know why, but I could tell something was wrong. And then when my mother showed up at my grandparents' house in a cop car with my uncle driving, I definitely knew something was wrong. And so my mother told us that daddy had shot Jeff, and whatever you do, don't look at the newspaper, don't look at TV. And so the first thing I did was look at the newspaper and look at TV. So the first time I saw it was like the 5 or 6 o'clock news that Saturday. And it was weird because it wasn't what I envisioned. You know, what I envisioned was somehow the runway and Jeff was coming down like the president's. Now the president's come down the steps and he was walking down the steps of the plane that way. And I didn't really know about the terminals, and because daddy went up to the terminal, but he didn't go through where you would go through the gate. So he didn't have to go through the metal detector. He just went to a local bunch of payphones and called his best friend. And I'll hear people go, oh, he was pretending to be on the phone. No, he wasn't. He was talking to his best friend. His best friend had called and warned them that my dad would be up there, that they needed to get in touch with Mike Burnett because there was somebody at the airport that was going to try to shoot the prisoner. And the guy called my dad's friend back and said he wasn't able to get in touch with Mike Burnett. And my dad's friend said, you're too late. I heard the shot. Because my dad said, here he comes. You're going to hear the shot. And then he pulled the trigger and he hung up the phone.
And, you know, Michelle already mentioned the media attention. So what was that like just locally? Like, what was that process unlike going back to school? And then how did people react in the community?
All right. So when I first went back to school, priority was getting my hair dyed back to blonde. So I walked back into school and I'm walking the door into the gym. That's where we go before class. And my friends were sitting on the stage across the gym. So I was walking across the middle of the basketball floor. And like, literally, I looked around and everyone was watching me. People watched me walk across the stage. So I walked to my friend Brian and he was there with a couple girls, friends of mine. And they decided they weren't going to act weird. They were just going to act normal, but they weren't. They were acting kind of kooky. And I figured, okay, you know what? I better break the ice. So I looked at him. I said, what are y'all looking at? Y'all looking at me like I've been kidnapped or something. And they started laughing and crying. And then so they gave me a hug. That's kind of how I broke the ice. Well, then when I got to homeroom, I walk in the homeroom and there's a big banner that says, welcome back. That's where the whole welcome back comes from. They had a big banner that said, welcome back, Jody. And everybody in the class had signed it. And they had taken my picture and my signature and they put it on the bulletin board next to the current events. Well, underneath the article of boy in plastic bubble dies is my picture and my signature. So when I got to class, I just looked at everybody. I said, well, y'all didn't give me much of a chance. And then they started laughing and they kind of like realized that I was the same person I was before I was kidnapped.
You seem really resilient.
I hope so. I try to be. I think what happened was, I guess we can credit daddy for it, is, I mean, I wasn't really going to tell anybody. I told my mother, my parents knew. I was just going to keep everything quiet. It wasn't until daddy shot Jeff that everybody else found out what had happened to me. So it wasn't one of those situations where someone's sexually abused, they keep it quiet for 20 years, start doing self-destructive behavior, you know, they get into drugs, alcohol, they start cutting themselves. I don't want to say other things that are normal because I don't want to label someone who might have multiple piercings as a sexual abuse victim, but a lot of times that is a signal of some type of childhood trauma, especially if she like cuts some people's arms and that kind of thing. And it might not be sexual abuse. It might be some other type of trauma, but those are indicators. You have different color hair, multicolored hair. And that's just how people deal with it. That's their coping skills.
You talk about coping skills. Could you tell us a little bit more about how it is to cope in a community where you're the kid who got kidnapped and you're the kid whose dad killed the kidnapper?
The one thing that I had is that a lot of people who were sexual, either rape victims or sexual abuse victims, and we've seen it in cases like the Steubenville sexual assault from, I think, 10 years ago. A lot of times people blame the victim. Oh, what was she doing? She should have been at the frat house drinking that much. You know, she should have known better. That didn't happen with me. No one ever blamed me. And we always had support. So it really wasn't that hard of a transition for me to be around a bunch of people who were very supportive. Only one kid ever said anything negative to me. And it didn't bother me. Like I said in the book, because I just listened to it. It wasn't like he revealed some top secret information that people didn't know. It was just disrespectful. And my classmates literally rallied together and they were going to beat him up. But he got off the bus and he sprinted home. And then after that, I guess his mother called the school. So they called us out of class to make sure that I wasn't going to mess him up. Because remember, I was in good shape. I just got to take karate. I could have done a number on him. But ironically enough, he passed away last year of cancer while in prison for child molestation.
I'm so glad to hear that you had a positive reaction from the kids. That just warms my little heart. And except for Crystal on Amazon, another shout out again to Crystal.
My next book might be, I hope you like this one, Crystal.
Great idea.
And I'll say this about Crystal. Okay. I don't know what led her or motivated her to buy my book. And maybe she's not in a place where she can learn from it. And maybe where she was at, I did seem like I was buying. So, you know, I don't fault her for that. I mean, people deal with trauma different ways. And again, I don't even know she's dealing with trauma. It may be a situation. I don't know. So Crystal, thank you for buying the book. And I'm sorry you didn't like it.
Are there any misconceptions that you would want to correct around your story?
Last week on Twitter, somebody talked about my dad's case for like an hour and 12 minutes. Another night I was sitting at home. I was like, all right, let's see how good she did. It wasn't bad. I really enjoyed the way she told the story. It's just really got a lot of stuff about my mom wrong. She said that my mother and Jeff were dating, that my mother was sleeping with Jeff, that when Jeff kidnapped me, she protected Jeff by not calling the cops for 4 days, but none of that was true. And so I reached out to her. She emailed me back. She's going to go back and tweak it. I sent her a copy of the book. So she's going to go back and make the corrections. And I can assure you, my mother and Jeff did not have a romantic relationship. And someone was like, well, there's documentation. There's an article written by Art Harris back from 1984 in the Washington Post that insinuating that my mother and Jeff were a couple. And even if my mother and Jeff were a couple, let's say they were dating, let's say they were married. It gave him no right to, one, take me, and two, sexually abuse me. So regardless of whether they were dated, it doesn't matter. But they weren't. I can assure you their relationship was not romantic. The other misconception, the police told my dad when they were like, the police set Jeff up. And then you can watch the videotape. If Bud Connor, when he started walking with Jeff, would have stopped right when they got to the payphones and let Jeff walk 10 feet in front of him, yeah, then I'd say Bud knew it. But I know Bud. His son graduated, my brother and sister. His son's like best friends with Shaquille O'Neal. I've seen Bud. We've talked. Mike Burnett, I see him around. I mean, I would see Bud around. And Bud sat with me and my friend Johnny for 2 hours talking to us. And he told me, he said, I was going to shoot your dad. He said, if you watch the video, I walk up and I put that gun to your dad's head. And he goes, I was going to pull that trigger. He said, the only reason why I didn't is because of that camera. So I can assure you, Mike Burnett, one, didn't want to lose a prisoner on TV. Bud had no clue, or he wouldn't have been standing next to him. That misconception that the police set Jeff up, that's definitely not true. Now, it was the news people who told me that.
Was there a moment when your family was able to come together where you kind of had this new normal, this kind of passing of the threshold, like you'd kind of moved on and were able to kind of heal together?
You know what? I would say after the sentencing and we found out my dad wasn't going to jail, but I think it was even before that. So when my dad did the shooting, my parents had been separated for like 9 months and, you know, he was drinking a lot. And after the shooting, he went to a psychiatric hospital for like a month where he was under psychiatric care. And after a month, he was released under the assertion that he would not be drinking. So my dad was told he can't drink. And so my mother said, if he doesn't drink, I don't have a problem with him. So after that month, he moved back into the house. He started putting ceiling fans and changing the wallpaper and putting new kitchen floors in. So he started doing projects around the house. And I would say once he came back, at least by that summer, I would say things were pretty much back to normal, like before we even knew Jeff.
You get asked a lot about what your opinion is on the type of sentences we should give sex offenders.
Not really. I think, you know, I mean, everybody would agree with me. I think that's too light. You know, you got to look at how you want to handle it. Also, you've got to look at the sex offense. I think you have to take it into consideration. For example, I'm using this example while he's in jail for sexual assault. The original Mystical case, when Mystical went to prison for sexually assaulting his hairdresser. All right, that wasn't a sexual motivated crime. That was a revenge-based crime because she had stolen money from me. So I think you have to take that into consideration. And if you look at, like, let's say somebody who was convicted and conviction was overturned, like Bill Cosby was drugging these women specifically to have sex with them unconscious. That's totally different things that you need to take that consideration. That's totally different than a 19-year-old senior who's been held back who has sex with a 16-year-old junior and they're in the same peer group than if a 40-year-old had sex with a 14-year-old. Those are two different dynamics. So I think you have to take some of that into consideration. But most of the time, when it comes to like violent sex offenders and pedophiles that are offending pedophiles, and I use that term because someone can be a pedophile and not be an offending pedophile. But if someone is an offending pedophile and someone has a violent sexual history, I think they're not going to change. And definitely the sentences need to be a lot longer.
So when you're not writing and you're not being a source of inspiration and an activist, what do you like to do in your free time?
You know what's sad is the last 2.5 years have kind of ruined me. Like, I'm perfectly happy just coming home and watching TV, which I used to never really watch TV. But I come home, watch TV, have a few drinks, and my brother lives across the street. So I'll go hang out with him. We'll watch Ted Lasso or episode of South Park. Sometimes I'll get off of work. I'll go to Twin Peaks or Hooters, have a beer. I normally have one and I come home, you know, so I do enjoy kind of being at home. But I also love to travel, which I haven't done in 2.5 years because of the COVID restrictions. But if I could take a trip to maybe go speak. But I love to travel. I love to go just experience different places, different settings, people. That's kind of my favorite thing.
We look forward to seeing you out there in the world. I'm sure that you'll be showing up on our radar. So thank you so much for your time and talking about hard stuff and everything in between. Thank you.
All right, no problem. And don't forget to send me your address so I can send you a book.
Thank
both
you.
Of y'all.
Thank you.
If y'all both need it, I'll send out each one.
We would love that.